This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to episode 352. One of my most favorite episodes. It's this one right here. Joe Galani, music executive, sure, sounds cool, but really one of the biggest, most influential ever in the history of country music, if not the most influential ever. He is going into the Country Music Hall of Fame, which is really, really hard to get into, even as a massive artist. Also going in this year is Keith Whitley, and Jerry Lee Lewis. Like, that should tell you, only three people. Many people were, it's just such a hard thing to get into, but he is, you know, that influential. And so, it's just stories about him going, well, yeah, I'm not scared to take it on. Let me see what I can do here. I believe in myself. Never done it before, but let's see what happens. And just saying, yeah, I'll try it. I mean, it's really cool. It's awesome, right?
Really cool.
Like, a little bit, I was like, dang, he's too big and too cool to be here in the studio. That's really how I felt. But I like him a whole lot, and I haven't spent a lot of time with him personally, but at the very end of this podcast, I do finally tell him and how he's kind of affected my life here in Nashville. I think he went through way earlier things that I went through way later, as far as people going, wait, you're not just like us. And he just crushed it. So, you know, he signed artists like Clint Black and Kenny Chesney, Sarah Evans, Vince Gill, The Judds, Martina McBride, Lori Morgan, Katie Osland, Carrie Underwood, Chris Young. I could go on, but just so many things that he talks about here are still happening. Because he was like, what if we did this? And it just worked, and he sold it. Anyway, that's the deal. He was like the youngest guy to run a record label back in the day, right?
Yep.
I don't think I'm making that part up.
That is correct.
And, you know, I did a thing where I'm super interested in the acts that he found and he discovered that ended up being big stars, and also his career. So I tried to make it like when I watch like a cool Netflix series and they kind of flash, not around, but they like cut two storylines back and forth.
Yeah.
And so we talk about an artist he signed. And then I'm like, all right, so this part of your career you did. And I tried to go back and forth a little bit just so it would be engaging to everyone if you wanted to hear about the artist he signed or his career. So I like it. I'm glad that you're here. This is a big one for us and a big one for me. And I don't think I screwed it up, which is just a relief. Because sometimes I'm like, well, I screwed that one up.
No, it was good.
Enjoy episode 352. Here you go, Joe Galani.
You know, Joe, we have important people that come by here, but then we have really important people that come by here. And so, I don't know what strings, who got you to come up here is my question, because, you know, somebody.
To you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Right there on the mic. We're talking the mic from right
sorry.
There. Yeah, how did I? Oh, he did.
Yeah. I've known him forever.
So Tom Becci is, for those listening, one of my managers. I have two managers, and Tom Becci is very well connected, and obviously Joe to get you up here. So I appreciate you coming up here. That's really nice of you.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you can pull that down if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
Whenever I saw, you know, it's always a big deal whenever they announce the Hall of Fame inductees, and I was just looking to see who was going to make it this year, because I know Ronnie and Kix got in last year, right. And I saw you, and I was like, holy crap, that's awesome. I was so excited for you, and I wonder, did you have any idea that you were up for it, that you would probably get it? Like, what did you know before they announced who was going in?
I knew I was on the ballot. And actually, I voted on the first round for, well, I can say his name, Irving Waugh. And the second ballot came out, and I was removed from the category in terms of being able to vote. And I called Brendan over at the CMA, and I said, what's up with that? He said, we can't have you voting for yourself. I said, I wasn't going to do that, but I completely get it.
So whenever they announced that you made it, because you've done so much, and we're going to talk about a lot of that, how does it make you feel at this stage of your career to, again, get probably one of your highest achievements?
It's not something that you really ever think about because it's such rarefied air that you really don't think you get there. And it's not something that I think most people that go in there really strive for. It just happens.
Right.
So humbled, honored, in disbelief.
Well, congratulations. That is quite the honor. And again, you've been honored in so many ways over so many years. This has got to be a quite, maybe refreshing is not the word for you. But I don't know, it almost probably feels new, like a new, something new for you. I feel like you've done so much.
Well.
Like to be in a Hall of Fame with all these country stars. Like, is there anything that's similar to this in your career?
No. I mean, when I did the, when Ronnie and Kix hosted the press conference for the nominees, and I was standing there just before I went up, and I looked to my left, and there's Hank Sr., and to the right is Patsy Cline. I went, what am I doing here? You know, it was surreal. It really was.
You mentioned that. And again, I can appreciate your humbleness, but what are you doing here? And I can list 10,000 reasons why you are in the Hall of Fame and have done so much. But I was kind of going over some of your personal history that we'll get to in a second, where you moved from New York down to Nashville and then back to New York and back to Nashville. But I just kind of want to start with some of the acts you've signed and kind of bounce around between your career and the acts that you've signed and what you saw in them early, because there is such a skill, maybe even an instinct, and you could tell me, you know, what part of your talent or gift that you use when finding these great acts. But if we were to talk about Alabama, mm-hmm. for example, what did you see in that group that early?
Actually, it was at the country radio seminar that I saw him for the first time. I'd heard about him several times, and my boss at that time was Jerry Bradley. And unbeknownst to me, he was tracking them at the same time that I was. And I went down. It was the, as you know, the show used to be just one band. And then everybody came up and sang with that one band.
So you mean there's like a house band and then all the artists would come in. Got it.
And so Alabama got up there and it was, you know, they didn't use the house band, but they were part of the house band. And I think that's always a tough gig anyhow. You know, I mean, it's everybody's sitting out there and you don't quite know what to expect and you're nervous. But they were natural born entertainers. The harmony was unbelievable. Randy Owen, still to this day, is one of the greatest country singers we've had.
Whenever there's a group like that, and I guess, what year?
81.
Okay. So 81 or so. And what was the wine and dine process like in 81? Or were they being pursued by multiple labels? I know you said someone else was tracking them as well. I have friends now that are, you know, people want to sign a deal and you have five labels coming at them and they're all promising them things and doing nice things. What was it like in 81 when you find an act that you really like?
There was nobody else pursuing them. They were on a small independent label called MDJ. And Dale Morris was the manager at that time. And so it really was just a direct negotiation between us. There was no other competition for them.
Whenever you sign them, do you say, all right, here's our vision for you? Or was Alabama so, did they know who they were at that point? How green were they when you signed them?
Oh, no, they were not green. I mean, from a live standpoint, they were seasoned.
And they've been doing it a long time, a lot of shows. Yeah.
And in terms of vision, I think at that time, we didn't know what the word vision meant. It was just, we like you. We think you got the potential and the songs. I mean, you know, my home's in Alabama, Tennessee River, mountain music feels so, I mean, you know, you get the story. It's just, it's all there. And they only got better as performers. And one of the first things that we did was we did a tour of rock and roll clubs like The Bottom Line and The Whiskey out in L.A., and we flew in a bunch of radio people and industry people. And even then, people were just going, we've just seen the country Beatles. And so it was early on in their career. But the other thing, too, was Randy Owen, the lead singer, was probably in another life, one of the best promotion people I've ever seen. He just locked on to both retailers and radio people. Anybody he had to know and take care of and make sure that they were doing a good job, he was focused on it.
You know, there's no such thing as a slam dunk, especially in anything creative, right? We may think we have it. There have been times where I've written things and I'm like, this is it. And it's not. It's just not. And there are times where it's just a throwaway something where I'm like, I don't know. I'm just going to. And it becomes this wild success. When you have something like Alabama, an entity like that, what was the first success with that band where you went, oh, yeah, like I knew they were good, but now we all know they're good and we're here with them, you know, in a business sense?
We got to Mountain Music. It was all over. But I'll take you back for a moment because country music at that point was still very much a regional format. You know, we were Southeast, Midwest, Southwest, a little bit of each of the coasts. And Alabama was the first act where you remember the Tower Record Stores,
mm-hmm.
where I actually went to the meeting with them and they went, what's up with this band? Normally they were like,
where they actually inquired that they wanted more about it.
Because their country section was about seven records deep. And they really were excited about it. So that was one of the first signs that we had that we were kind of getting outside the neighborhood.
You grew up in New York, right? And so what town?
It was actually Queens.
Okay, so you grew
Archie, up... Archie Bunker territory.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So when that show was on, did it feel like that was happening in your neighborhood?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could relate because all those houses were built the same. They were all attached in row after row of those, block after block.
So you grow up, and what music is influencing you in, you know, the 60s?
Stones, Beatles, Dave Clark Five, all, you know, anything that was, the British Invasion was huge at that point, you know, Little Richard, I mean, it was just typical rock and roll.
So for you growing up in a time where, like, even if I look back, I mean, that was probably music at its peak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever that, I think that culture consumed so much. They owned so much of the market share, we'll call it that. Why get into music, though, professionally? What made you go, I got to do this, not just to listen, I want to get a record and just listen to it and love it. Why would you want to get into it all the time?
Well, I actually, when I came out of college, I interviewed with several companies, and RCA is one of the two companies that offered me a gig. And at that point, when I was interviewing, I was a little too cocky at that point. I was sitting down. The guy was the head of finance, and I said to him, what division? Because it was RCA, so it was Carnet Carpet, Banquet Foods, Random House, NBC, and then RCA Records. And I said, what's RCA Records? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm an avid collector. I don't have any of yours. I know my labels, and I don't have one of your things. What do you mean? You know, we're very strong in show tunes and we're very strong in classical music. Now I'm looking at him going, really? So I went to work for RCA, and it was not something I was thinking about as a music career. I was just thinking about a career.
Like a job?
Yeah. I'm out of school. I got a wife. I got a kid. Let's go.
What did you do in school? Like when you were going to college, what did you think you were going to do?
I came out. I was looking for business opportunities. I was a finance major and a marketing minor.
So you studied money. You studied marketing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much you studied anything about music or...
No. I played in a band, and I was pretty poor at it. And, you know, loved music, listened. I mean, I still remember walking around with that transistor radio when we were kids, just listening to WABC radio.
You go to RCA in what year?
71.
And in that 3 or 4 years before you come to Nashville... Like, what were your job duties? And my assumption is you climbed pretty fast in New York. So what'd you start as, and what did you end as in New York?
I ended up as a product manager. So I had my elite roster at that point because I was the kid that they didn't know a whole lot. They gave me this struggling artist called David Bowie and Lou Reed and several other acts that nobody really remembers at all.
And if RCA was, like you mentioned... Just to paraphrase what you said, like they had a lot of show tunes. You know, David Bowie, Lou Reed, that's not quite show tunes. Were they going into a new kind of area?
Yeah, when I joined, they weren't on the label. And certainly they hadn't succeeded. They had things like The Main Ingredient at that point and Buffalo Springfield for a brief second. You know, that kind of, it was more one-hit wonders than it was anything else.
Back in 74, so what my assumption would be is that most country music was on an AM radio?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why would a fellow like yourself, who's doing pretty good in New York, decide to move to Nashville to pursue a career in a format that's mostly on AM radio? And I'm assuming you didn't grow up around a lot of country music.
Only country music I heard was on AM radio. So Johnny Cash, Eddie Arnold, Skeeter Davis, that guy. If they crossed, I heard it.
Like a Johnny Cash would cross. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So you moved. And how did you get approached about moving to Nashville?
I got called into the office of the general manager and the head of human resources and said, we have got a great idea. We think you should move to Nashville.
And your initial instinct was?
Hell no. What's down there? Why would I want to go down there? I'm here. I'm in New York.
Right.
And their instructions to me were, just go down there for 2 years. I think it'll be a good experience for you. You'll learn the inner workings of a smaller operation. And if you don't like it, you can come back. And so I came down and met with Jerry Bradley downtown at the Hilton Hotel. And when I got back on the plane and I went home to my wife, I said, well, I'm not going to get that job because I know I pissed him off. You know, we weren't on the same page. So I go into the office. That was a Friday, and I came back to the office on the Monday. They called me in, and I went, I'm expecting to hear, hey, it's all over. And they said, he loved you. You're going down. And I went, oh, no.
What'd you tell your wife?
Only 2 years. It's only 2 years.
So do you think they were being truthful when they said go learn it and come back, or do you think they really maybe had you in mind to go down and actually make something of it?
No. At that point, it was really just go down and see what you can. You know, companies at that point were really A&R entities, and there were promotion departments, and everything else was out in New York. It really wasn't. It was a small business, and people were still learning how to, you know, market and develop artists on a national basis, forget international.
So you're in your early 30s when you come to Nashville?
Actually, 24.
Wow, you're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
So you moved down. And you're working at RCA, but what is your job when you move here first? Because I know you're one of the youngest, if not the youngest person to take over a major label. But so you move here in your 20s, what do you do?
I had the glorious title of manager of administration, which really meant whatever Jerry wanted me to do, I did. But it really was trying to bring some semblance of order to the various departments, trying to get them involved with the corporation overall, the RCA Corporation. I mean, I had been in the company a number of years. I had a lot of friends in the promotion department and sales department. So Jerry was, hey, go up there and meet with them, see what you can do for our records. And that was part of what I did.
I'm going to come back to that in a minute. And that's where we are. You've just arrived in Nashville, and you have a job that sounds like I don't know what it is because the words are so vague, right? You're doing it all.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah.
Let's move over a bit and go to another artist, Kenny Chesney.
Mm-hmm.
So you met Kenny around what year?
90.
And what did he have going for him when you met him?
Well, the story is Dale Morris. We're coming back to the same person. Dale Morris, I was getting ready to move back to Nashville from running the company in New York. And Dale called me over the weekend and said, I've got this kid, Kenny Chesney. I said, who's Kenny Chesney? Well, he's on Capricorn. I think you'd really like him. I said, well, send me the record, and we'll have a conversation. So I got the record, and I thought it was interesting.
In what way?
As a songwriter, I thought he had a unique perspective. He was a country singer, which at that point, from looking at the roster, we certainly could use a few more of those. And he had been out working the road. You know, I mean, he had been working through the whole process. I had a respect for Capricorn Records. And Dale said, I think I can get him off. So that's what we went down the road.
So Capricorn Records, my assumption is, I've never heard of Capricorn. I'm assuming they're not around anymore. Maybe they are.
Allman Brothers and those kind of guys. Phil Walden was the original guy that ran that company.
Small?
Yeah.
So Kenny's on a small independent label, and so you guys identify him as someone that you think you could make into a major star.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the records, you listen to it, he has an interesting perspective and an interesting way to present things. So you call him up, you go see him, what happens?
Actually, we met months later in the office, and he was young. I mean, he came in, it was almost like George Strait light. I mean, he was really trying. That was one
was
of
he cowboy hat then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy to think about Hat at Kenny.
Yeah.
He's just not that anymore. It hasn't been for a long time. And so he says to you, like, what's Kenny Chesney's goal? Because he's on Capricorn, and you guys are, you think there's a nice relationship that can happen there. What does Kenny Chesney tell you he wants to do with his career at that point?
He wants to be one of those guys that everybody, you know, Phil, well, stadiums weren't in the conversation at that point. So it's Phil Arenas, and I want to be one of the biggest stars out there.
And I'm sure a lot of people say that. I mean, I think pretty much everybody probably says that. I want to be a big star.
Sure.
But why was Kenny different as far as, aside from the record that you heard and you thought his presentation was interesting and his songwriting, but why Kenny and why did you think he could be the massive star that he is now?
He worked his ass off. And, I mean, he really, whatever he didn't have as a skill, as an entertainer or as a writer, he would go out and find those guys and spend the time to learn. I always thought it was interesting. When he was in town, he was always going to see shows. Something he continued on much later on, you know. He went out and toured with Alabama when he didn't need to tour with Alabama. He'd go out and open for George Jones when he didn't need to open for George. He just wanted to learn. How do you entertain? What are you doing that makes it so different? And they were, you know, his heroes at the same time.
When did Kenny go from being a guy that had some moderate to good radio success to being a superstar in your mind?
Early 2000s.
And what was it? A song? Was it
How Forever Feels?
That was the one. And you promise you're where you are. I'm sure there are certain songs where you can just feel it. You're like, okay, we're looking at sales or we're looking at concert tickets. Like, this is the element that is changing it.
He actually was doing better business concert wise than we were doing on records at that point.
So he was making more money at live shows than you were selling. He was selling records.
Yeah, but I mean, what you had were people. But think about back then in the late 90s, there's no internet. People were just showing up. It's word of mouth. And so people were going out to see him. And what we needed to do was connect the dots. He had, you know, we'd have a hit, then we'd have a miss. We'd have a hit, we'd have a miss. How Forever Feels was the first time we started a string where we just kept going at it.
Well, that string, the consistency of the string, what you say you started hitting them in a row, what was the consistent?
I mean, in terms of numbers or?
No, in terms of you started to put them together. But what were the, was it a certain texture of the songs, a tempo, an idea? Was he Beach Kenny yet? What was it?
No, he hadn't reached Beach Kenny yet. He was getting there. And he was developing the identity, you know, coming out with the rock and roll T-shirts, the tight jeans, the whole routine, working out, physically getting there because it was a physically demanding job that he had, and really spending the money on the production. He knew that he needed to make a bigger and bigger show. But, you know, when we made records, we pulled four singles off, sometimes five singles, and left singles on the album that we could have pulled out. So the quality of the music was there. And it was everything from the beach, but then you'd go through There Goes My Life. You know, I mean, you know, it covered the gamut. And occasionally he would write them, but most of the time they were outside writers.
You know, I often say that I love Slow Kenny. Like, I connect with Slow Kenny. Anytime Kenny's doing a ballad or slightly slower than mid, like, those are my Kenny Chesney songs.
Tequila.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's one of my favorite songs ever.
Yeah.
And so, like, Slow Kenny, that's my jam. Sometimes when he does the beach stuff and the fast stuff, I don't even like the beach. So I'm like, you know what? I'll pass on this one. But, like, man, the guy's got an emotional catalog. So Kenny Chesney, big star, Mount Rushmore of artists since 1990 for sure. This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go back to New York. You moved to Nashville. You're working as some administration position. And so do you start to climb here?
Yeah.
Was that a goal of yours to climb here? Was it a goal of New York's for you to climb here?
New York, at that point, I think I was off the radar in New York for that two-year period. We check in occasionally with each other. But I think the turning point for me was that Jerry Bradley began to see, when I go to New York, I'd bring something back that helped us. And I had this conversation with him one day because I was not in charge of promotion, but I was trying to figure everything out in terms of country radio. I really had not been involved with the format. And we kept getting these records that didn't quite compete with everybody else on the charts. But I mean, to the most of us, it sounded like we should be competing. So I dove into promotion and tried to start figuring out, meeting with people, going out with the promotion guys, hitting radio stations. And, you know, I came into Jerry one day and I said, you know, we're not doing what we need to be doing. And he looked at me and he said, well, goddamn it, go figure it out. I said, well, I'm not in charge of promotion. He said, you just go figure it out. I'll take care of it from there. So I came back and I said, well, here are the things that we need to do. He said, okay, I'll put you in charge. And I went, wait. I haven't run a staff. You know, I've been in promotion, but I haven't run a staff. And so that was the trial by fire.
And that fire, as you're in the fire, do you realize that it's easier or harder, or that you're naturally good at it, or it's something that maybe you didn't have the instinct for, but you could work really hard and figure it out? Like, where did you fall when you got into this promotions world and now you're running it?
I felt like I could do it, but I needed the experience. You know, I was surrounded by other labels where guys had been doing this stuff for 10 or 15 years. I've been doing it for 15 or 20 months. So it took me time to build those relationships and understand the system, but then I went after it.
Did you feel like a little bit that you were at the right age at a time when things were changing and you had the right vision and mindset? Because again, if you're working with guys that have been doing it 15 years, I mean, even, you know, in 83, 84, 85, it's a significant change since 75, 76, oh, yeah, as far as technology. I think I got lucky being this age because I was using the internet and, you know, doing podcasting stuff before everybody was doing it. But I happened to be very young at the right time. And so everyone's like, wow, look at this guy. He's doing all this revolutionary stuff. No, I was just 22. Right. It really wasn't revolutionary. I just was young doing it. Did you find that a bit of that was because you were younger and you were actually using the technology of the day instead of having to learn it at an older age?
Yeah, that was part of it. But I also think, just like you, you given an opportunity, you went after it, and you were not afraid of trying things. And that gave you the entree. Same thing with me. I was not afraid of trying, failing if I need, but I was going to go after it. And, you know, anytime I needed to be on an airplane, out in L.A., out in New York, out in Dallas, I just went. And you build those relationships, and you begin to understand the stations and the personalities and the markets, and that really did help me when I went back to the artists and said, look, this is what's coming back about the music. and why we're not succeeding. Or if we were succeeding, this is all the good news, and there's not really a lot of bad news. And at that point, we had not developed a system. We were just getting to the point of, you know, the tracking systems like the BDS and MediaBase. That was just coming on. You were still dealing in archaic systems where people were, it's in power.
They would just say how many times they played it, and you had to believe them.
Absolutely.
Wow. So you're credited with really changing the formula of how promotion is done to sell records. What did you do in your mind that was so different?
Well, one of the things was bringing the new artists out. I mean, we created the original promo tour. I mean, Loretta was the person that did it. And we just used the same model. It started with the Judds, and we went out with the Judds and took them into studios and brought radio people into studios. And that worked. But what we found out later on when we did KT and Clint was that if we went to the actual stations, then people went in there, you met everybody in the station. They, you know, they'd cut jingles, they'd cut liners. So there was an advantage to going to the marketplace. Prior to that, people didn't really travel around to radio stations.
Is it crazy to you that that's still the thing?
It's a personal business. You know, it's nice to play it, but you want to know something about them. Sometimes that personal relationship is what gets you over the hump to adding a record.
So what I hear you saying is people.
Always a people business. Whether it be a songwriter, a producer, or a manager, it's always people.
Let's go to the Judds for a second. Growing up for me, massive, because my mom loved them. She would sing them all the time. Like, one of the memories I have of my mother is her singing Why Not Me? Or just, it was all Judds all the time. And, you know, you have a mom and a daughter, and I don't know that I have seen that before, a straight mom and a daughter that made it to a level like the Judds, or even a mid-level. So you're signing them. You got to invest money in them. Like, what did you see about those two that made you think that was something to put a bunch of money into and believe in?
We used to, when we would go out to L.A., we'd stay at this little hotel called Le Parc. And the guy that was in charge of Curb Productions, Dick Whitehouse, who passed away about a year and a half ago, he and I had been trying to do business for a while, just had never hit on anything. So we had breakfast, and we were in the suite talking, and he was getting ready to leave. And I said to him, "You got anything for me?" He said, "Well, I've got this mother-daughter, and I've got a work tape, but it's not ready. I'll wait till we get back." I said,
"What do you think, though, when you hear mother-daughter? Before anything else?"
Oh, it's magic.
If you hear, "I have a mother-daughter," are you like, "That's so original that if they're good, I want it"?
Absolutely.
Because I've never heard mother-daughter. You know, before them, and I don't know and have the experience you have of being around, I just haven't heard a mother-daughter do it on a level of contemporary.
And they were, even on the demos, they were great. So I said, "Look, I'm going to be back in Nashville on Monday. Why don't we get together anytime next week? You tell me when." So I think it was Wednesday or Thursday of that week. Went on in. Naomi came in. Three songs. They walk out. I called Dick and said, we've got to make a deal. And we did that day.
What are they, and maybe you don't remember, but what are they coming in saying? Do they have a guitar? Are they doing acapella stuff?
No, they had a guitar. And, you know, Y was playing and singing, and they were doing the harmony. And Naomi is entertaining, telling you the stories. And honestly, don't remember at this point.
So Wynonna then must have, how old was she? She's a teenager, obviously.
16?
Yeah, 16, 17?
I thought 16, 15.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
And to have a, you know, you hear about stage parents a lot. That's a literal stage parent. That's a parent on stage with you, and you're doing it together. What was that dynamic like for them early? Because they're equal stars.
Yeah.
But they're not equal in the house.
Yeah.
So I would assume that's managing that dynamic would have been tough.
It took a moment. I think that, you know, Y was beginning to see that she was the center of attention. But she did need her mom for the harmony part and also for the entertainment part. And Y just was really good talking to people. You know, Naomi was. Y was still, she was a kid.
Yeah.
But she was gaining the experience rapidly.
So you're going station to station. You're figuring it out. Your data is happening because you found a new technique, right? Mm-hmm. And you're starting to slowly see it. When do other companies start to see what you're doing and how it's working? And they start to mimic what you're doing?
Several years later. But you just, you know, then we went from, you know, those promo visits to the bus tour. We would go around the country on a bus. And at first we did it just as a label going into radio stations, you know, and hitting them and taking them on the bus, showing the videos, playing on the music, talking for a while, you know, three cities a day, just kept going around the country for 4 or 5 months. And then we got the idea to start doing bus tours where you would bring the artist to the radio station on the bus and, again, take them on, spend the time. We had that locked down for a couple of years before somebody said, oh, we'll do that too.
It's also a costly.
Yeah.
I mean, it costs a lot of money to move an artist around for months in a bus.
And it's time consuming for your staff, coordinating everything, you know, getting everything together, making sure that you've got everything you need. And at the same time, promo guys have to keep, you know, working on those records. So
you're promo touring, you're head of promotions. When does that turn into, or maybe there's a couple steps in between, but when do you actually take the helm?
Jerry stepped down in 82, so I took it right after that.
And how did that feel to you? Like, it's my time, or like, holy crap?
No, I know at that time the company was kind of like, are you ready for this? I went, yeah.
Is it because your age?
Yeah.
More than anything else, because it sounds like you've done things that nobody else has done. You've seen things in ways that haven't been seen, and had you maybe been 45, they wouldn't have asked the question, possibly. So you're 32, and they say you're ready for this. And what do you say?
Yeah.
What did you feel, though, inside your heart?
Yeah, I felt like I could do it. You know, I mean, again, just as I said before about running a staff, running a label is a different thing than being like the GM. You know, the buck stops there.
What new responsibility did you have running a label that maybe you didn't know you were going to have when running a label?
When you start building a roster, that's a completely different experience than just working records.
Because?
You're painting a picture. What you really do see should represent this label. And where are the holes in the marketplace? What has the competition got? What do you have? Can you do better than they are in the various areas? You could have three women on the roster, but maybe they weren't better than Trisha Yearwood. You know, you got to find where. And so we had the Judds, you know, you could crack through. And, you know, moved on to Lori Morgan. And, you know, it was just working through that process of trying to find. When you build a label, you build a catalog. And you have to have those artists that are going to have a long tail, be able to sell for a long period of time. If you just have a series of one-hit wonders, you're just constantly spinning. You're on a gerbil wheel. But building,
yeah,
you know, you have to be consistent about the music, consistent about the moves with the manager in terms of touring. What are you doing on the TV personnel? How do you get them on shows? Moving through the entire process.
I have a friend who is a pitching coach at a major university, and another school called him and said, hey, why don't you come and be the manager? He's like, great. Always been looking for the opportunity to be a manager. He gets over and he realizes he does really enjoy the job, and you know, he loves being a manager, but he can't spend as much time with the pitchers anymore. Like, the thing that got him there that he loved to do, that he invested all this time in learning and teaching and communication, in talking about pitching, he could not do as much. So here you are. You've created a new template for promotion and finding artists. But now you're running a label. Did it pull you away from what you were really great at a bit, and where you couldn't spend as much time? Obviously, you couldn't be on the road as much. But did it take you away from what you loved? And did you have to find people that had similar vision as you?
There's no way you do this as an individual. You have to have a team. And that was really, I think for me, a process of learning how to pick the right people, which allowed me to spend less time in the field and more time with the artists. But more time with the artists also meant not just the studio, but being on the road. So it was a balancing act.
As the head, who was your first major success that wasn't already on the artist? Like, you couldn't, let's say we take everybody off the table that you'd already found, you'd nourished, but you're the head, you find somebody brand new. First major success running the label.
Judds. Judds were the first one through.
Were you running the label when you found them?
Oh, yeah.
You were?
Oh, yeah.
And so is there a different kind of... you know, just being straight proud whenever you're the head guy, is it a different feeling?
Well, the moment for me was when Conway Twitty, my assistant, said, Conway Twitty's on the phone for you. I said, Conway? He said, I just heard the Judds. You done a damn good thing, boy. And hung up. It was like, okay, I got the stamp of approval.
Clint Black. who I think it's so cool. I have a relationship with Clint now. And growing up in Mountain Pine, Arkansas, I knew every Clint Black song. I mean, he was just a hero musically to me and someone that I never thought I'd get to know, much less be friends with. I mean, guy is smart as a whip, like funny. And when people come into my show, for the most part, I feel like they'll come in, put some bowling bumpers up, take care of them, you know, make them look good. That's my job, make them look good. They'll sound good, but I make them. But Clint, there ain't no bumpers, and I got to watch out because he's gonna give it to me real good.
Yeah.
So tell me about meeting Clint and what it was with Clint that what it was about Clint that made you go, that guy's a star.
Well, first is the voice. Second was the look. Third, I found out how funny and smart he was because, you know, you go in and you meet the guy and, you know, you're a little bit intimidated. And it just took a little bit of time for us to break the ice. But then you just said, man, this guy, he can really wrap his arms around a crowd and they just feel like it's family. And then the songs, I mean, just one after another, you know, I mean, Killing Time, No News. I mean, just the way we went through that. And he was... yes, he was a country singer, but at the same time, he was one soulful son of a bitch. I mean, just the ability for him to just approach each of his songs a different way, sometimes live. Not just give you the 3-minute version, but do what Clint can do, which is just wail, and then play. I saw him over the course of the tour, the first couple of years, really get to be a guitarist. Prior to that, he was a rhythm player, but he did learn how to play. And lead guitar.
Sarah Evans.
Yeah.
Whenever you signed Sarah Evans, what was it that drew you to her? Because she's a bit of a wild card, and I enjoy being around her because I never know what I'm going to get with Sarah. Was she like that in her early days?
Yeah. And that first record we made with Pete Anderson was really a throwback to Loretta Lynn days. Reviewed critically, but not commercially successful. Big personality, big voice. Great at collaborating with people. So it was a process, again, almost like Kenny to a certain degree. You know, we'd get one, lose one, get one, lose one. And then No Place That Far came out. We got Vince on the background at that point. Just started taking off from there.
So you're running the label. You put in 9, 10, 11 years or so as the head at first?
Before I moved to New York?
Yeah, about a decade or so.
Yeah.
For you, before you moved to New York, before you came back, what was the high point in that first decade run for you as far as your career?
You know, I mean, I think we had been named Label of the Year for a decade.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and that was pretty powerful stuff for us, you know, because people would come in and out of that slot, and we held it.
Were you so hard to get a hold of? You're King Dingling in Nashville. Everybody, you could change lives like that. I mean, you were the biggest guy in town. I got to imagine everywhere you went, somebody was trying to hand you a tape, something, calling your office, dressing up like a delivery man coming in. That stuff had to be happening to you all the time.
If somebody called me, I returned the call within 24 hours. I always did that. I didn't leave the office till I was done. It was about relationships. And you can ask anybody that worked for me or worked with me all during those years. I called you back.
The king of Nashville is calling people back all day.
Yeah. I mean, that's the job. You got to stay in touch with everybody.
I mean, I get it. But I would just think at some point when everybody wants to get in touch with you, that it will be hard to have enough capacity.
Well, you'd start setting up where you have an A&R department, or you have a promotion department. You go see so-and-so.
Yeah.
And if you then come back to me, but not directly.
Why do you go back to New York?
It was the reverse of the argument that got me down here. I went to, my boss came down from BMG, and I thought he was hinting around about me going to work in New York. And I said, no, I'm happy here. Everything's good. I was about to get married. We had planned the wedding and for November and just at the beginning of August, I just finished a worldwide meeting. Everything had gone well. I get the phone call, and he says, come on up. I'd just like to have dinner with you. That's strange. So I go up, and he said, I'd like you to take over the label, running all the divisions. And I said, Michael, I thought we rule that out. He said, no, you're the right guy for it. He said, but you've got 5 hours to make the decision. When this dinner is done, I need your answer by 11 o'clock tonight.
Well, how do you even have a dinner now that you got to have a decision? That's all I'll be thinking about is trying to run through my head all the scenarios.
And that's
the guy
the way
wants
it
me
worked.
To pass the mashed potatoes.
And I went back to the room and called my fiance at that point, Fran Schwartz, and I said, I think I can do this. Are you up for it? We were both ex-New Yorkers. Sounded like a good idea at the time. And so I called him back and went into the office the next day. He fired the president that morning, and I walked in, called everybody in, had our first powwow, got back on the plane and went back to Nashville because I came up there with like an overnight bag. I went back, and then, all hell break loose, because I'm going to have to move to New York. I'm about to get married. I mean, it's just crazy. So,
and what does your fiance think about the move back home?
She was excited about it because she was a New Yorker. The unfortunate problem was she was working for Arista with Tim Dubois. She was one of the original founding members of the Arista group. And then she goes up there, and she doesn't have that job anymore. So she's got to go find a job up there. We're trying to find living in New York and get used to the roster. You get 100 acts where we had, 15. It's a different world completely.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Were you more excited about going home or a different challenge?
It's a different challenge.
And what was different about it? Maybe the difference was just how wide the net was. All different sounds and different types of artists.
I had the jazz department, the R&B department at that point, the rock department, and then pop, and then country reporting to me. So it was the whole portfolio.
Do you have a part in hiring your replacement in Nashville?
Yes.
And so you go up. I was just kind of looking at some of the stuff you did when you went back, and I'm a fan of both or two of the acts that are directly credited to you, one of them being Dave. So Dave Matthews Band, How does he and that group get to you?
Well, we're pre-internet, and so kids at that point, as you may remember, when you went to see a band, you'd make a cassette tape, and then you pass it around the dorm. And we had a group of college interns, and this one college intern said, all my friends down here in the South, they got this guy, Dave Matthews Band, and, you know, you need to listen to this.
That's how it got to you?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Went to the college department reported to one of the guys in A&R, who actually is here, Pete Robinson, is here in Nashville as a publisher. And we went to Wetlands, Butch Waugh, myself, a few other guys, and we walked into this place. The show was supposed to be at 2 o'clock in the morning. Walk in at like 1.
2 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah. Walk in there. There's nobody there. And I'm looking at the A&R group going, 2:01, about 75 guys start walking in, ball caps, chinos. About 2:05, the place is packed out. And everybody's doing the same thing, taking the cassette player, putting it in front of the band. Dave comes out, and I looked at Butch at one point. We're probably halfway through the set. And I said, you think you can get any of this stuff on the radio? He said, I don't know about that, Joe.
Was it long jam band stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I said, I think we just go for this, because regardless of whether it goes on the radio or not, this is the most exciting thing I've seen in years. And then we went down and negotiated with Corn Capshaw. And we actually put the record out, because MTV at that point was the 800-pound gorilla. And we put an independent record out, hit everything. No affiliation to RCA. People saw this record come out. They were jumping on it.
Did you hide it because of what their brand was?
No, we hid it because we knew that if we put it out, MTV wouldn't be as excited about it because they like the indie stuff.
I got it. So, okay. So MTV's brand played into it.
Yep.
Got it.
MTV started going, well, you guys, you need to pursue this. And I said, yeah, we'll get it. Got it. Started making the videos. Went on MTV. And then everybody figured out later on it was an end around.
You mentioned Corin. That's like my guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he's, you know, Dave was playing in his bar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, found the bassist and, you know, put that. I mean, what a story.
And what a way to build a career, the way he built it throughout the touring spectrum. I mean, unbelievable. The first gig that Dave played west of the Mississippi was in Seattle at our annual meeting. He had never been up there. But again, people flocked in.
Was it a convincing that you had to do with Dave to go, hey, let's make these songs 3.5 minutes and let's make, you know, real, obviously real catchy hooks, and, you know, what you do is awesome, but for the radio, it's a different animal? Or did he get it?
You just let him go. You know, I think our format is that animal. Dave was a completely different entity, completely. You just let him do what he did. You know, it was funny. We did an international meeting. We had started to really, you know, gold, 750,000 units. And I went to an international meeting in Barcelona, and I was all excited because these guys have been waiting for us to come up with something for years, and we just hadn't delivered. So I walk in there, and I do my presentation, and, you know, I've got Dave on the big screen and everything, and we're doing the video and everything. And I look out, and most of the international guys have got their heads down at the desk. They are not interested. They're sleeping. They're napping. And they just never got it. It was an American thing.
What do you think that thing is? Like, what about it is so American that someone international wouldn't get?
3.5 minutes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, tour? Yeah, if you want a tour, which he didn't really do a whole lot of, but not for the radio.
Wu-Tang. I mean, again, Wu-Tang was everywhere for me as a kid. Not the same as Dave,
no.
You know. It's so. What about Wu-Tang? And at what stage did you start to get to know the guys?
We had done a production deal with a guy named Steve Rifkin. Loud Records was the name of it. Not Big Loud, Loud. And we had had a couple of, you know, get to first base, and that's as far as you went with a couple of the acts. And they brought in the Wu-Tang and the demos of that, and everybody in the company just flipped. So, you know, it was part of the deal itself, so we got it, and then we started to develop it.
Was it interesting to you guys in a positive way that they all had their own independent personalities and names and characteristics. Yeah. I mean, because in hip-hop groups, for the most part, when I was a kid, they didn't all stand out as individually and then work as well together at the same time. And all the guys, I mean, they did so much stuff separate, but they were always Wu-Tang. So that was a positive with you guys?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you had all the, and you saw it on stage. They were all distinct personalities. And I mean, and it was East Coast. You know, there was the West Coast out there, and you had all the Dr. Dre's and everything else, but this was an East Coast band. And they really did move the needle. Hot 97, I mean, you know, it was when there was rhythm stations out there.
Was there a decision to make when they wanted to do solo stuff of which ones of them that you would sign and which ones you wouldn't? Or did you, because I don't think you signed them all, did you, individually?
No, not at that point. By the time they started doing solo, I was gone.
Okay. So, okay, you're gone.
Where, that was quick.
All right. Where'd you go?
I went back home.
And why back to Nashville?
That process, my boss had a very unrealistic expectation.
In New York?
Yeah. He thought, you can turn this thing around in a heartbeat. And we were so far down in the hole, we didn't register on any meter.
So it's like turning, I got a CDL license for a TV show, and I realized that turning around an 18-wheeler, you can't just turn around an 18-wheeler. It is very slow, very methodical. And if someone's like, you turn this around real quick, it just didn't happen. Like, you wish it, but it wouldn't happen.
First year, 18 months, was getting rid of people and acts. I dropped 60 acts. 60.
18 months. The intro stage was 18 months.
Change all the people, drop all the acts. None of the acts came back to haunt us. And then you start building your team. And that takes time. And then what started to happen was then, you know, Dave comes on board, SWV, Wu-Tang. But I just wasn't having the fun because you were trying to serve too many masters. And the expectation was we should be doing a lot more a lot sooner. And I just kept going, it's going to take more time. It's going to take more. No. And I went, look, you know what? Maybe we're not meant for each other. So I'll leave and I'll go back to Nashville. I'll find a gig. And then that's when he said, no. You're not going to go to work for somebody else. You're going to go work for us. And so I moved back here.
When you moved back, did it feel like home again?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, you know, I'd been out of Nashville for 4 years. Things had started to change. SoundScan had come on board. So now you really started to see what was happening with record selling. And, you know, players were different. You got to get back down here, meet all the songwriters, all the publishers. Everybody knew me, but you still got to get in the pecking order. You know, how do you jump ahead?
Isn't it crazy in 4 years in the creative space? I mean, it's like dog years.
Yeah.
You're gone 4 years. It's not 4 years. That's generations, because you've had so many even small changes in how the art is done, who the writers are, people that are coming with new ideas creatively.
Yep.
So you come back after 4 years. What'd you find the biggest change was after that short time that really wasn't that short?
Well, first thing I did was I went back out to the radio stations and I said, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I mean, I can read a chart, but what's going on in the marketplace? And the artists themselves, you know, we were at that point where there was going to be a new group of people coming through. The Brooks and Dunns and Alan Jacksons had really started to come on strong, but there was room for more. And so it was an opportunity. It was just going out there and finding out, okay, tell me what's working, what's not working. What are you missing? One of the things they told me was, you know, people become stars, they never come back to visit us. So, you know, we'd start taking the artists out again, you know, the Alabamas of the world, go out there and see the radio stations, and you curry favor and you get the opportunities. And the first act that I signed when we were down there was Minnie McCready. And, you know, we had a double platinum record out of the gate, and then, you know, started again with Lori Morgan and, you know, John Anderson, and just things started to click. But it took a couple years.
Did you feel like you brought back the people element, and somehow in 4 years, people didn't value it as much?
Well, I think that, you know, people looked at it and said, well, you know, can he do this again? I don't think so. You know, and so there was a lot of, well, prove it to me. And I went, okay, I'll prove it to you. And it took us probably 3 years to get ourselves back in, because the roster had started to fall apart too. And then we came back basically, you know, with the RCA label group, with RCA and B&A, changed the way we were staffing the label and how we were approaching things. And then I spent a lot of time during the first couple of years basically taking songwriters. I'd take them over to the house I just sit down with them and say, look, this is what we're going to do. Give us an opportunity. If we don't do what we said we're going to do, you don't need to give us the songs, but give me a jump ball. And I did that with a bunch of writers and, you know, found that we started getting the songs again. And you know this town. It's songs.
Yeah.
You know, you get that going, you know, we can make good records. There are a lot of great producers here and musicians, but you need the damn songs and you need them continually. And so we did the same thing with songwriters and publishers that we do to radio, treated them better than anybody else. And they found that when we went after it, you gave us a record, we did the job.
In my, I guess, 10 years or so here now, I've seen a couple of real, you know, meteoric type successes where someone's like, bam, here I am, boom, superstar. Doesn't happen a lot. Maybe only two that I look at and go, dang, that was quick, and that was like extreme success. I missed the Aldean. I missed Aldean. I wasn't here. I heard that was a kind of a rocket ship.
Yep.
I was here right after FGL, so I did not see that. And I hear that was kind of a rocket ship. Obviously, I've been here for Combs, Luke Combs. I've seen nothing like that before. And even Sam. You know, Sam, same kind of way. Different, just launched, universally loved until he got so loved that some people had to be like, I don't love Sam anymore. You know, and I think that's always been the goal, is get so big that you have some sort of backlash, right? Because that just means you're a monster. Who am I missing? And I'm sure I miss many. Who else did you see come into town and just kind of go, all right, I'm here, I've got something a little different, and then boom, away it went.
What period you're talking about in the last period?
No, I'm talking about in just your whole time in Nashville, because I've only been able to see the last 10.
The Chicks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Faith.
The Chicks seem to be so different. Was there, and this analogy is not going to be good when I use Sam, but that's all I can really lean on, is that Sam was, and listen, Sam is as country as it gets, as a person, and grew up. Did the Chicks have any, like, they're not country. Did that happen at all?
Not at all.
Even though Natalie was, really?
Yeah.
Or their sound is different. How about their sound is not, really?
Yeah. I mean, those records just, they exploded. And when they got on stage, you know, they really shined in award shows.
So the Chicks, who else? If you can think
Faith?
Of, yeah.
I mean, Faith, definitely. I mean, you know, you start off doing covers, and then you all of a sudden you wind up with a song like Breathe. It's huge. It just, you know, that pop crossover changes the game dramatically. But the question always is the same thing. How do you follow that? And what do you start doing musically? Do you stay true to your country roots, or do you follow what New York and LA are saying? Give me more of that. And when you do give me more of that, you kind of lose the country base. And that's what happens. You don't get that success.
Shania, were you here when that was?
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, it was, we couldn't believe the numbers. I mean, all of us on the other side were going, what the? That can't be. And it was. And it was international. And that very rarely happened.
So you have these monster stars in Nashville. And as someone that's an international star like Shania, could she be in Nashville and still feel safe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the record, as long as, you know, it's the same old thing. If the music is there, you're okay. And you can go internationally, but the reality is when the music starts to tail off, then everybody starts poking holes in you.
And by tail off, you mean if it's not country. You mean the country folk will be like...
Yeah, people would take the crossover and be happy with it. But when you start losing and you start, again, you go to the other side making records for pop and not considering your country base, that's when you have a problem.
Let me ask you about outlaw country for a second, because the more I read about it, and I do consider myself a bit of a country music historian, in that, you know, if they do a documentary on some of the older stars that I grew up watching with my grandmother, she was the whole influence on me, right? If it's when they shot the PBS Charlie Pride, I was right there. Like, I freaking love Charlie Pride. And so I feel like I got a lot of it down just through learning and reading and watching videos. But the outlaw country thing's interesting to me. And slap me in the head and tell me I'm wrong. But I feel like at first that was very much a marketing tactic.
It was.
And now there's this romantic with old school country fans that it wasn't, that they were just robbing stores and...
Well, I think they ran parallel tracks. I mean, the idea was, you know, Jerry Bradley, who I was working for, as I said earlier, remember the Time Life series of those books?
Mm-hmm.
He took that art, and that's what was the outlaw. That was the basic outline of the album, and called it Outlaw, The Outlaws. And, you know, I don't know, Tom Paul was an outlaw, neither was Jesse at that point. But Willie and Waylon, you know, bucked the system. At that time, You were supposed to be recording in RCA Studios or Columbia Studios. That was part of the deal. We had a union. And both of those guys, that's really where the Outlaw came from. We're not going to record there. You guys are, you know, you're on the clock. I don't want to have to follow the clock. I want to be able to record when I want to record. And if I want to go over, I'm going to go over. And I'll pay the overtime for it. And that just didn't sit well with the powers that be. And so they did stuff outside the system. And that was Outlaw.
So that, not punching record executives in the face.
No.
Spitting on. It's Outlaw. And that, again, the formula that had been built, they were just going, we don't want to live in this formula because we feel like we can create in a better way, in a different way.
Yeah. And also they were, the way they approached their music, they were covering, you know, Bob Seger. What has Bob Seger got to do with country? The lyric. I mean, Waylon just, you know, supporting Steve Earle when the town wasn't supporting Steve Earle. It really was about the music, the music, the music. If you were with him on the music, you're good to go. Regardless if it went up or it went down, he didn't care. He just wanted to make his brand of music. Same with Willie.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
My grandmother would tell me, because Johnny Cash is from Arkansas, that's where we grew up, and that she would go to some Johnny Cash shows before he really blew up and crossed over because, you know, rock, pop, he was everywhere. Christian, you know, he just covered it all. But when he was a country artist, and she knew he was a country artist, people would be at the shows being, he's not country. Like, angry. Like, he's not country. And it feels to me like that has always been universally said, like, since the beginning. Like, any sort of movement in any direction, it's always said, well, that ain't country. Did you find that to be frustrating in your time?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I remember the first time we worked Carrie on Jesus Take the Wheel. And, you know, we had a bunch of stations coming back and going, oh, she's an American Idol winner. She's not country. Go, listen to the song. What are you talking about? She's not country. You know, girls from Oklahoma.
Listen to her talk.
Yeah. What do you want? I mean, you know, she was on a show that gave her a platform, but it doesn't mean that she's not who she is in her heart. But I think that's, you know, we go back to, you know, Olivia Newton-John, John Denver, when they were on the country charts. You know, you had people, Oliver Newton-John. You know, she's not country. What's he doing here?
I mean, Burning the Slip with his name on it for Entertainer of the Year.
Yeah, Charlie Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there at that show.
You were
there? Yeah, oh, yeah.
And so, I've seen the show. I've seen the presentation there. I've seen, you know, John Denver. He's not there, obviously. Right. In the room, are people like, ha-ha, that's funny? Or are they like, yeah, that's right? Like, what?
You know, I think, going back at that point, a large part of it too is it's a business. So what is John Denver doing for you as a publisher or you as a manager or you as an agent or you? I mean, aside from us, RCA, having the John Denver catalog, we're one of the few beneficiaries in the town. There were some people who had parts of songs, but it, you know, normally when, you know, Luke Combs wins or Morgan Wallen wins or, you know, Eric Church wins, publishers in the town, producers in the town, everybody's sharing in the excitement and the wealth to a certain degree. But also, they feel like it's here. You've recorded in Nashville. You've made the record in Nashville. So it's that sense of ownership and also protection to a certain degree.
So then by that logic, John Denver was outlaw country.
I don't know he would ever said, yeah. Yeah, I get the point.
I mean, and John Denver made country songs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, this song says, thank God I'm a country boy.
And when he did the award show, they were highlights.
Yeah.
You know, the music shuts everybody up at the end of the day, because when you beam in and you're not there, that's one thing. But when you get on there and you bring that fiddle out and everybody goes, well, I guess he is country.
Heck yeah. So, like Rocky Mountain, I mean, I can go through all the John Denver songs where I'm just like, I, at this stage in 2022, am a bit in disbelief that John Denver, finger quotes, wasn't country. Now, I understand why you're saying that, because people feel like, oh, he's not one of our group.
Right.
That's helping the we'll call it an economy. That's helping the economy here. But how do they not think John Denver's country? I love John Denver, and always, you know, he wasn't even from the Rocky Mountains. Is what's crazy. Like, to me, in my head, he's marketed as the mountain man.
Right.
But yeah, he definitely made some country music. Well, you're going to the Hall of Fame. I just so cool. I wish I could be more poignant there. But that is just so freaking cool that you're going to the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Thank you. One of the things I've been doing over the last decade is I've been going to those press conferences, and just because I've had so many artists that I've signed or friends who have gone in. And I think of all the things that I've done, it's one of the most intimate nights and special nights. You know, we're always used to big things, especially in our award shows and everything else. But this is a much smaller, more intimate part of it. And it represents people that aren't always entertainers and recognizes their work. So, you know, Eddie Bears goes in, or, you know, you sit there and you go, oh, my God. And you hear the story. You understand what's going on, you know, and it could be Ronnie and Kix. I mean, when Ronnie and Kix were getting ready to introduce me, we were talking about what was your reaction when you heard about it. And Kix looked at Ronnie and he said, we just looked at one another and went, you got to be kidding me. You know, which is basically how I felt, like, because you really don't expect. And I don't think anybody ever aims for it. You just do your job. And, you know, the gods smile upon you, you get in there.
Man, I got three final things for you. Number one's Keith Whitley. He's going in with you.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Keith?
Oh, God, the voice, the smile, the sense of humor. The love of the format. My God. He just, you know, I think back to those, when it's the same thing, you start to go down that path and it's just bump after bump and you're finally starting to make your headway, Miami, Miami, you know, you're starting to get there. You make this record that would have catapulted him into the Male Vocalist of the Year on No Stranger to the Rain. You know, you just go, oh my God. And then he's gone. And then the fact that it was Laurie and Keith, it would have been George and Tammy all over again, because those two singing together, those are two great classic country voices. But Keith, you know, you were talking about, well, I was talking to you before about being a label head. And I mean, I had dealt with Waylon through some of the drug problems and him getting clean, but I hadn't been on the other side. I had been an observer. And nobody tells you about addiction. You know, it's not something that, you know, you learn as you're getting in this whole thing, but, you know, we tried so many different ways to get Keith to get clean. And, you know, I remember sitting down talking to the therapist and saying, if he doesn't want to do it, you can't make him do it. And so it was one of those things that you just, it was such a loss and such a waste at the same time.
This is a very personal question regarding that. And I'll tell you, I had the same situation with my mom. And, you know, my mom died very young of drugs and alcohol. And I would check her into rehabs and I would say the same thing. Like, what do we got to do here? And they're like, well, you can do this and you can pound the hammer and you can. But if she doesn't want to do it, it is never going to happen. And that was a really hard thing for me to accept, Don't know that I still accept it, honestly. Yeah. I get it. I understand it, but it's a very, very difficult thing for me. And there's still guilt that I have, even trying to facilitate, trying to support, you know, with you going through that situation with him. Any of those feelings?
Oh, yeah. Because what happened was Laurie called me. We were launching Laurie's record, and we were about to do the promo tour. And she called, and she said, what do I do? I mean, I don't know whether he can handle my being gone. I said, Laurie, it's your call, but this is what you want to do. I mean, is there going to be anybody with Keith? And she said, yeah, there will be people with him. And the decision was made to move forward. But when he died, my fiance and Randy Goodman came running in to Maud's down the row at that point. I was having lunch with Eddie Arnold and motioned for me to come over and said, Keith just died. And so I hurried through my lunch with Eddie because we had to find Laurie. Laurie was on the road. Nobody had cell phones. She was in a car going, and you did not want to hear that come over the air. Hey, Keith Whitley has just died. We're really sad about that. And she's in a freaking car. And we found her in Seattle, thank God, before it happened, and then flew her back. But I remember getting that album and driving around the row for hours, just playing it over and over again, because Garth Fundis and I had gone in the studio, and I went, it's that album that you're just sitting there going, oh my God, this is perfection. Commercially, artistically, it is the soul that he has. It's there. And then just crying because did I do the right thing? You know,
I appreciate you sharing that story with me. This is number 2 of 3. You miss it? You know, you're retired now. What I know, what I can sense in you, you're such a creative, even though I don't know if you'll give yourself credit for being a creative, you are, because you've changed so many things in how this industry was, is, and is still doing. I mean, it's still working toward. Do you miss it?
I miss the process of making the music. I don't miss all the bull that we went through now, especially with the corporations and all the initiatives they have and the way the system has changed, where people are, it's so much about data and not enough to me about gut, because I can't tell you how many times we made a decision and it was kind of like, let's take this shot. Mm. And you know, it's a game of chances. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And you could have all the data in the world. Doesn't mean that somebody, you were talking about before in terms of songs,
right?
You think this works? It doesn't. No, I didn't think this one would. It's just that game. You don't know till the people get a chance to really spend the time with it. But that's the part I miss. However, you know, I've spent that time since I stepped down with the CMA, and I still work with Kenny. So I get my fix.
Yeah.
You know, it comes in, and it comes in lots of different ways, working with Robert Deaton on the award shows and everything else. But no, not anymore. I mean, you know, I feel like when I ended, you know, Miranda was the last act that I actually broke through, and that felt great. And so to see what she's doing after that has been really satisfying. But no, I'm good.
I guess that's how you want to feel. That's awesome.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say is, and it's not really a question, but it's more of a, just from me to you, a very personal thing. It's, you know, when I got to this town, maybe I remember it differently. I didn't feel very welcomed here for a while, for many years. You know, I didn't wear a cowboy hat. I definitely grew up in a rural part of the South, but also had influences that weren't just country, and was very open about it on a platform that wasn't really appreciated, especially at the time. Now, culture's changed. I think I've been a big part of trying to move it forward a little bit, while also appreciating the history of it. And from in my career, doing radio, doing television, doing comedy and books and all these things that I've just never knew how to do, I just attack and just punch until something moves, you know? And then you're like, oh, that moves. If I punch, let me keep going. Over the past 4, 5, or 6 years, you know, it's been, hey, we have this award show, and I'll be in the conversation to host the show, and I'll hear the people that are like, you can't, other radio companies, no, we don't want him. We'll boycott the show if he did. The one person that it comes back to me who is constantly publicly or privately in my corner, as in, you just have to consider this guy because he has the skill set to do it, and he should at least be looked at, is you. And I didn't even know you. And they would come back and say, you know who's kind of got your back? And I was like, well, I wouldn't even go say hi to him. Like, he's too much of a bigwig. I would never go. And so my introduction to appreciating you as a person was, it didn't have to be me, but you were just sticking up for somebody you didn't know. You had no interest in me. Not as a pro. We don't know each other. It wasn't like you're fighting for your friend, but I just always appreciated that because I know that wasn't the popular thing to do. And you're in there with a bunch of radio people. And listen, it's changed a little now. And I get to turn stuff down now, which is the coolest thing ever. The greatest thing.
But you worked for that opportunity.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And, there have been offers and situations. And now I get to go, I don't think this is right for me. But I didn't always get to do that. But the one person that people would come and go, hey, man, Joe's like saying they should stop just shutting it down immediately and at least look at it was you. So just eyeball to eyeball, like, I just really appreciated that because I didn't feel like I had any allies in this town.
I think the town, I went through the same thing you did when I first got here. The last thing I did was feel at home. It took quite some time. You know, you're the outsider. You are the outsider and you're trying to do things that are different. I got this message from Charlie Monk. He called me after the announcement, and he said, he left the voicemail. I still have it here. I kept it. He said, you know, when I met you, I thought you were a goddamn snot-nosed Yankee kid who couldn't do shit. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff. And so he said, and I called him back, and I said, I was that guy. But, you know, I learned, and I went through it, and I gained respect and love for what I was doing and the people around, and you did the same thing. I mean, to be honest with you, the first time I met you, I don't know if you remember this, was over at John Ivey's house. I think it was a holiday. You had just gotten to town. And John was, I mean, John has been a friend of mine for...
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, long. And he's been great to us as a company for a long period of time. Because he was always that guy that would go, eh. I mean, one of the stories I have on John was... In New York, he said, he called Butch and he said, where were you when the world stopped turning? He said, if you can get Alan to take the steel out of that song, I'll play it.
On Kiss FM Los Angeles, pop station, yeah.
And I said, Butch, I'll make the call, but I got to tell you, Alan Jackson and no steel, I don't think that's happening. Call Alan. I said, Alan, the big top 40 radio station will play this record. This guy's a really good friend of ours, but I don't know how you feel about this. Well, what do they want? Take the steel out. It's like one, two, three. I like steel. End of story. But John is a guy that if he comes in and says, guy's going to do something, you know, I'm good. We've been together a long time through the trenches. But quite honestly, I mean, what you've done, I mean, you know, people are betting against you and you just go, no, I can do this. And you've done that. And you've gone outside of the genre. And, you know, you'll keep working at your craft and keep improving and widening the goalposts for yourself. So congratulations to yourself.
Well, not about me. I just wanted to say I appreciated you. You've impacted my confidence in the town. And so I appreciate that. But congratulations, man. Thanks. Just awesome. It's an honor to have you here for an hour. You have affected this format in so many ways that people don't even know. And you probably don't even remember all the ways. It's one after the other. I could do 3 hours. But I injured my calf because I'm getting older. Now I got to go to a physical therapist. It's life. It's life now.
We're both injured right now.
I live hurt, yeah.
I don't think I've had this kind of edge on my voice in a long time. I'm sorry about it.
Well, Joe, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
I'll just end with that. Thank you. This has been a real treat, and hopefully I'll see you soon.
You will. Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.